stay tuned and welcome back, Dr. Future.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks.
Why do we never get?
Welcome back to the show. We're back after a great time out east. Two words for you. Niagara Falls. Step by step. Yep, we were at Niagara Falls. Thanks, Sam, for welcoming us back. Appreciate that. And Mrs. Future, glad you're here.
Well, thank you, honey. It's been quite a lovely ride.
Nothing quite as amazing as looking at that falls firsthand.
That's true. Definitely one of those markers of eternity. It just really leaves you forever changed.
If you get there, we would suggest having lunch at the Skylon Towers. That's on the Canadian side. Looking down, you see both of the falls from this rotating restaurant above them. And it's just a stunning view.
Yeah.
And if you get a chance after that to go down and get in one of the boats and go out into the waters under the falls, which is spectacular. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. And the weather the day we were there was just perfect. It was really warm. It was the kind of day you want to go jump in the water anyway. So
yes, it was warm,
we got completely doused with the falls and we loved every minute of it.
I had a lot of fun with the 360 camera shooting the experience.
That's right.
And it captures a little bit. I think I'll put it up on our website for you to look at.
Yeah. It's really cool to be able to share the entire immersion experience in every direction, 360 degrees. You can really feel like you're there.
Yes. Yes. And a shout out to our Montreal friends who are listening. So we stayed in Montreal with my family and friends. Anyway, my mother lives there. It was fantastic to spend time with.
And I want to thank our guest hosts who were here. I hope you guys really enjoyed the shows from the lovers of KSCO. I remember the last one was
the top 10
Michael
things
Harrison.
Of the future.
And yes, the top 10 things of the future and what to be worried about.
Is this a simulation or what?
We listened to the show, of course, from where we were and would have had some very interesting engagement with our guest host last time. So we'll save that for a future show.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we do have some really interesting headlines for the first hour and the second hour. We're going to delve into what's going to be a growing controversy in the very near future, something you probably have heard nothing about yet, but nonetheless will become important and has to do with orbital space art.
Space art.
It's not just the scientists.
A raging debate.
Yes, it's not just the scientists playing with space anymore. But space art could affect us all.
Yes.
And we're going to be looking at that topic.
Yes. And it's amazing. The space art community has a very deep history, and there's a very evolved conversation about art and space.
Especially stuff that could be seen by millions of people at once. Yeah, let's go through some of our news, shall we?
Ready when you are.
Bless you. First of all, we've been covering the Opportunity rover for some time. That's the OPI that came down on 04 within the Martian surface.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been silent since June 10th when a planet-wide dust storm cut off solar power.
This storm is off the charts. There has never been a storm like this recorded since we've been recording storms on Mars.
Right. I think we've got a live feed from OPI, don't we?
You want to hear it?
Like,
okay. Here's what's coming in from the storms on Mars. And this one is covering the whole planet. Can you imagine a storm that is covering the whole planet? I just learned that the surface area of Mars is just about the equivalent of all of the land mass that's not submerged under the ocean on Earth.
Wow.
So can you imagine a storm covering every single part of our land?
Everyone has the same weather. Hey, what's the weather today? Oh, well, take a look.
That's right.
The same here as it is in Timbuktu.
That's right. And it's just like a big sand dune. There's just all kinds of dust that's being kicked up and spread around. But it turns out that the main problem is, of course, the winds are fairly strong. But the main problem for us is that opportunity can't get sunlight through this storm. It's just black.
Plays havoc with solar panels. But they do think that the global dust storm is decaying. Basically, that more dust is falling out of the atmosphere than is being raised back into it. So the skies might soon clear enough for that little solar-powered rover to recharge and attempt to phone home from this storm.
I love this article that you put in here. It really tells you what survival is like for the Mars rover, for Opportunity, and just how the team prepared for this eventuality. And Opportunity was supposed to work for maybe about 6 months, and it's going on 14 years, or maybe 15 years, that it's been working. And everybody is just holding their breath and hoping that at the end of this storm that's been raging since June, that Opportunity is going to have everything it needs to wake up.
The biggest concern was the state of its batteries. When was the last time you used 15-year-old rechargeable batteries? Rovers, that's what they're using. So far, so good. Not too much degradation. And next couple of weeks, we hope to hear from Opie again.
You might like to tune into this article if you want to hear the scientists discuss the storm, which is remarkable. And also how the rover is staying warm on Mars, and learn about the fact that it's Martian summer.
That's right. They have a nuclear battery on board, too.
They do.
Besides the usual.
There's some plutonium keeping the rover warm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's not enough to run everything.
No, they don't run the electricity from the plutonium. They run the electricity from the solar panels.
Plutonium is good for heat to keep it from freezing up.
Yeah, basically it's completely shut down. It doesn't do anything right now except power its clock. And then the clock tells it when to wake up if it's warm enough and check for contact with, say, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter.
Right.
Or the deep space network that will send a message back to home base and let them know that the Opportunity is waking up.
Yes. Here's hoping we'll hear from Opportunity in the next couple of weeks. We'll keep you posted.
Okay. Stay tuned. And we'll be right back.
Back to the show, folks. We also have a probe that's approaching a big asteroid in near-Earth orbit. One of our probes from NASA is approaching the asteroid Bennu, B-E-N-N-U. It's called the Cirrus-Rex spacecraft. It began the final approach towards the big near-Earth asteroid last Friday. It marks the official start of the Cirrus-Rex asteroid operations mission.
I think they pronounce that OSIRIS.
OSIRIS? Yeah. Cirrus? OSIRIS? Okay.
Of course, it's just letters that are standing in for other words. So you can pronounce
it
any way
Egyptian,
you want.
Sounds very Egyptian, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's really the OSIRIS.
OSIRIS-REx.
Yes. OSIRIS is how you say the Egyptian god.
Right. You know what it's short for?
No.
Origins, Spectral Interpretation, Resource Identification, Security, Regolith Explorer.
Well, that's a mouthful.
Just say OSIRIS-REx. You'll remember. It's after a 2-year journey, it began asteroid operations. It has its own Twitter. And if you subscribe to the OSIRIS-REx, NASA's OSIRIS-REx, it says, "Today, after a nearly 2-year journey, I began asteroid operations in my final approach towards Bennu."
Cool.
Yes. So it'll report directly to us.
OSIRIS-REx has a Twitter account.
Yes, just like the president. Goes directly to us. Not past go. Do not go to space.com.
Great. We really have very humanified objects floating up there in space, don't we?
Yeah, as the
AI is. An asteroid probe.
Yes.
We've got a robot on Mars.
Well, all of these things, the asteroid AIs, all these AIs, we're going to start having more and more personalities, I predict.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
In the future, AIs often have personalities. Not necessarily. Depends on whether they have to deal with humans or not. They don't need personalities if they're not dealing with humans.
Right.
But they are. It's
really
best to have.
Depends on the humans who put them
together.
We
like personalities, you know? We relate to them. It's very mammalian. It's very soft and fuzzy to have a personality.
Yes.
And that's good.
Well, with a name like Osiris Rex, that's pretty interesting. That's an Egyptian dinosaur. I mean, it really plays with your mythical references.
Yes. Early Egyptian explorations of the desert.
Right. And it's going to an asteroid that it took 2 years to get to. So now it's going to take another 2-3 months to land on it. And
well, the big part about this is that it's going to land on it, take a piece of the asteroid, and bring it back to Earth.
Ooh.
Right? We've never really done a mission like that before.
It's going to go in the Guinness Book of World Records. Yeah. First time we brought stuff back from an asteroid.
Take the dust and run.
That's right. Any other asteroid stuff we have. Hi, Rosie.
Yeah.
Any other asteroid stuff we have brought itself here to Earth and deposited itself.
Yeah. So it's exciting time to study asteroids. They're also, Japan is having a spacecraft that's going to be in orbit near the near-Earth asteroid Ryugu, R-Y-U-G-U. Mm-hmm. And they'll also grab samples. And they're scheduled to bring them down in late 2020.
Okay.
So we're starting to grab stuff from the solar system and bring it back.
Oh, the era of space mining has begun.
Yes, interactive.
I guess you could say moon rocks was space mining.
Right? Yeah, people brought it back from
back
there,
from
right?
The moon,
that's
so
true.
It began a while ago.
Samples. I mean, the science is all about samples.
Yeah.
Right. Bring your samples back.
Yeah, maybe it's not mining if it's just samples. Yeah. We're still exploring.
Yeah.
We're researching.
Yeah, we got to study samples. So we're going to give some samples back from the asteroids. The asteroids promise to give us everything. Mm-hmm. They have not just dust, but they have rare earth minerals, elements. They have radioactive components. They have diamonds and rubies and platinum, apparently lots of platinum.
Hmm.
So they're rich in resources, and they're kind of like the Home Depot of the solar system.
Mm-hmm. We hope.
Mm-hmm. But hopefully they're not Home Despot, depending on who runs the asteroid belt. But yes, they are a tremendous resource and will help us become a solar system economy. So that's exciting news in the space world. Also, we found that there's a lot of water on Mars. JPL and just announced that we've had confirmation that we've had a tremendous amount of water found at the poles. Excuse me, on the moon, not just Mars. We have.
Get your planet
I get my planet straight, right? And that's
get
not
your
a planet.
Satellite
that's my solar celestial object straight. You're right. We have found water on the moon as well,
mm-hmm.
But we're also talking about the closer celestial body here.
The moon.
The moon. The lunar.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
This is exciting because it means that we just might be able to set up bases on the moon and have resources to support people there.
Right. It means that when we start traveling to the moon, we don't all have to have a still suit like in Dune where we recycle our own urine so that we have something to drink.
Well, they're still going to recycle every drop of water. You can count on that. But the fact that they have a lot of it there means we don't have to carry it there.
Right. We'll have a little bit more than just what we bring with us.
Or somehow get an asteroid to crash into the moon with lots of water. And, you know, that's a much harder mission.
I don't know. It might be kind of hard to harvest water on the moon if it's just around the South Pole. I mean, imagine trying to harvest water that's frozen around the South Pole here. It's hardly worth it.
Well, it depends on what you're doing on the moon.
Yeah.
What makes it worth it. You know, and then there's a lot of debate about that. Is it really something that we should do? Should we even go on the surface? But it's so much easier to create space stations in orbit and live on them.
Yeah, I imagine that we're going to create space stations first because we have to have a self-contained environment. And it's going to be easier to do it without all of the hazards of being on a planet or being on a moon. But of course, then, once we've mastered Starship Enterprise, having our own spaceship take care of all our needs, including our holodeck for entertainment.
Yes.
Then it'll be easy to go explore the planets and have lots of away teams.
That's right. That's right. And Star Trek did set the example of having a spaceship that doesn't land anywhere.
That's right.
Yeah. You stay on that.
That's right.
If you're going to go somewhere, you visit it and you come back.
Right. Right. So space hotels. I'd say space hotels first. We've got the International Space Station. Now we need a whole bunch of space destinations.
So most of the newfound water ice lies in the shadows of craters near the poles. where the warmest temperature never reaches above minus 250 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, minus 250 degrees. Who is going to want to go there? You can't wear a bathing suit.
Sunlight never reaches those regions. Not good for humans.
Yeah.
I'll give you that.
No, you will not want to get out of your spaceship, for sure.
Yeah. So they think the top few millimeters of the surface might be the ice. That would allow us to basically have mining operations there. Right? And because the moon has a lot of minerals as well.
Uh-huh.
And has potentially value there.
Now, you're trying to get me excited?
The thing is,
mining operations?
No, look, I know. Mining is not a very sexy term. I know. But it's.
I don't know. Maybe I'll just stay home and watch a movie.
Yeah, let's be eco here and not extract stuff and leave it where it is and make something out of nothing.
That's not what I'm saying.
Where the universe came from anyway.
I'm
nothing.
Just noticing how excited you are.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I like to get excited about lunar operations. Sure. But they'd mostly be robotic. I don't necessarily find it appealing to hang out there for any length of time. I don't think any of us would.
Oh, okay. Got it.
But how many of us hang out where mining operations are today on the Earth?
Uh-huh.
Nobody.
Okay.
Right? So it's the same thing.
Okay. So the main people going to space, they're going to be like the pit crew for the robots.
Well, they're going to run the machines, yeah.
Uh-huh.
They're going to be a large part of that. And you can do a lot of that from Earth, from the lunar surface to the Earth. It's not so bad. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, I think that's one of the Google X prizes. Was to send a craft to the moon, have it drive around there and take pictures. And if you did that, you win the $10 million for the prize.
Nobody won it yet, right?
No. Okay. No, it takes a lot to get there. I don't think it's a big problem designing a craft that can take pictures with no atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But to get to the moon is the hard part right now.
Yes. Have to agree with that.
That's right. That's why we have places like the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who specialize in getting things there and building craft once you're there. So that's a little bit of the moon. That's kind of exciting this week. It just came in on August 20th. On the Earth side of things, we have a whole new generation of giant telescopes that just broke ground this week as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Giant telescopes on Earth.
Huge giant telescopes, yes. This will allow us to study the sky and space like we've never done before.
Okay.
The giant Magellan Telescope in Chile. It's a billion-dollar project that will allow us to see to the very edge of the universe as we know it. It's got another 6 years to build before it's done, but it will have an array of seven huge mirrors about 80 feet in diameter. 80 feet mirrors.
Studying the edges of the universe.
Seven 80-foot mirrors.
Wow.
And that'll give us 10 times the precision of the Hubble telescope.
Ten times
better than the Hubble on the Earth.
That's quite an accomplishment.
Yes.
So it's an array telescope. So what is it measuring? It's using radio waves, not light?
Well, this is light. It uses advanced technology to correct for the distortion effects of the Earth's atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
It makes hundreds of adjustments per second of its array of secondary mirrors to compensate for distortion created by atmospheric effects.
Huh.
And you'll see this in Hawaii. The telescopes send a laser beam up. You see beam go up, and that is measuring the atmosphere.
Oh.
That's giving us feedback as to what the atmospheric distortion might be.
Oh, so we're calibrating with respect to one beam of light that we send out, and then all the light that's coming through the atmosphere.
Then it compensates for that and cancels out the effects of distortion that are created by the atmosphere.
Interesting.
By adjusting little mirrors, an array of secondary mirrors.
This is so fascinating because what they're measuring is something that is just so tiny, just a little tiny speck of light, imperceptible to the human eye, that persists over the time frame of pointing the telescope at it.
Yeah, all the time in the atmosphere.
AI can see it as a persistent object and then measure what it is.
Yeah, you might say it takes the twinkle out of the star. Just the twinkle is caused by the atmosphere.
Right. What's that twinkle made of? That's what I want to know.
How do they twinkle? What is going on in there? It's not going on in them at all. It's in our atmosphere that causes the twinkle. And that's what we got to compensate for. So there you have it. All right. Another half hour, then we're going to get into some interesting debates here on space art and its impact on all of us.
All right. Right here on the Dr. Future Show. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. So we did get a query about why are we spending so much money looking out at the universe?
Yeah,
well,
why?
Why? $1 billion?
Mm-hmm.
Because it looks like there's a lot out there that we don't know about. It's like we're like a tiny grain of sand.
We might be spending $12 billion a year at NASA and more than that in the military and in all the space programs around the world.
Yeah, on life.
Even if we spend $1 trillion Earth dollars, which is barely anything, we might make $1 trillion the first time we bring resources back from an asteroid.
Easily, yeah. And as it is, we're a grain of sand in a vast universe, and we're beginning to really get more of a sense of what that universe is and how it works.
Yeah,
more information is better at this point.
Yeah, and everything will change as the scope of our reach changes.
Like one of the things that we found this week, or perhaps I should say over the last year, because these scientific studies that we mention on the show often take years to complete, and we announce them as if it's just
happened. What happened is the results were published in a scientific journal.
And one of the things we've been studying has been the exoplanet phenomenon since 1992, I believe, and we found our first one, that there are other solar systems with planets, and they're very prevalent, and they're everywhere. We're finding now, and we're getting more and more information about these planets. Most of them were giant gas planets. Not too many of them were rocky worlds like ours.
Mm-hmm.
But we're finding now the more and more water worlds of the Milky Way.
Water Worlds of the Milky Way. That sounds like a great book, great novel, maybe a great
movie. Water Worlds of the Milky Way.
Yeah.
There's quite a few of them. And, you know, we're not really a water world ourselves. We barely have any water compared to these other worlds.
Really? It just looks like we have water, but it's all close to the surface.
The sun did one really nasty, bright blast. It could vaporize him.
Like what happened to Mars. Mars water vaporized. Maybe it wasn't a blast from the sun. But
sun could do that.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, it hasn't. And I have a feeling the sun
likes us.
Yeah. It's kind of weird, part of her family.
It's our mom.
But you never
pop.
Know. You know, she might want to waste a planet when things go down.
Yeah. Let's hope she doesn't get a period.
Let's hope. I think the danger there is putting too much human values on planetary structures.
Yeah. They have a very different psychology than us humans, us monkeys.
Yeah.
Our worlds are much smaller.
So what we do know is that the intermediate-sized exoplanets, the smaller ones, the ones that aren't gas giants, could be water worlds with vast amounts of water. But we don't know if they're liquid or it's thick steam. We're still got to figure that part out.
Yeah, all we know is that we can spot the H2O with our spectral analysis. That's what we know these water worlds.
And we have TESS up there now. TESS is a satellite called the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. And it's really just begun its mission to search for more details about these exoplanets. But what we're finding is that about 35% of all known exoplanets, which are bigger than the Earth, could be water rich.
Mm-hmm.
And these likely formed in similar ways to our giant planet cores, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune.
Hmm.
So this is
looking at the actual observation data on the few 10,000 or so exoplanets
that we found so far, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. There's a huge surprise to realize that there might be many water worlds. That's one of the big insights.
35%, that's a lot.
You start seeing them and you say, oh, bummer, they're all gas giants. That's not good for us. But it turns out that there are a lot of water worlds. Scientists have
more arguments for getting to space in boats, big old ships.
Well, we're going to need more than we're gonna kind of ship to get light years away.
Yeah, you know, we want a ship that can deploy a
minor
ski
detail.
Boat to a water world, so that when we get to the water world, we send the away team down in something that floats on the water in the water world, and then we can cruise around.
Yeah, or maybe a submarine.
Right.
Well, they found that of the 4,000 confirmed candidate exoplanets, so far they fall into two sizes, those with a planetary radius about 1.5 that of the Earth, and those averaging about 2.5 times the radius of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
The smaller ones, the 1.5 Earth radius, tend to be more rocky planets, while the bigger ones are the gas giants.
Mm-hmm.
So it's expected to be hot water, though, which could be good for making steam, I suppose. But 200 to 400, 500 degrees Celsius is what they think a lot of the water is on these planets.
Mm.
just not friendly for us again. But then again, we're looking for any form of biological life. It doesn't necessarily have to be advanced biology like us. It could be simple microbial. Mm-hmm. You know, if anyways you can find something.
Right. And we're still saying that water is the clue.
Yeah.
Water is what lets us know that there's life like we know.
Yeah. Now, there's some controversy over this. They're thinking if you find a water planet, it doesn't necessarily contain life because it's beginning to look more and more like in order to have life, you need to have some land as well as water on a planet.
Back to the old hot tub idea.
Well, kind of, you need land and
the gel.
The kind of things that land brings to the environment.
Water evaporates in the pools on the side, on the land. Like
Dr. Damer's approach.
That's
Dr.
right.
Damer.
Origin of life.
Right, origin of life.
Our colonies all started in hot springs. Not springs, pools.
Well, started in the, what gets me is the importance of the bathtub ring.
Tidal pools.
The tidal pool bathtub ring was the key to the origins of biological life.
That's right, It's alive.
So we got to have planets that have that to really be like Earth, you know, to have both land and sea, not just water. And most of these are probably water. 400, 500 degrees. So not real friendly for life as we know it. Hmm. However, that's
except
water.
Except for the natural mermaids.
Yeah,
there are people who prefer water to land. You can spot them. Yeah. They usually like to wear blue.
Yeah. Blue is a very good color, especially if the sun is kind of a yellow. So that was cool. I thought that we're finding more water planets and that looks promising. Meanwhile, on Earth, we've been destroying our oceans and polluting them like crazy, and the coral reefs are dying. Very sad. However, the world's largest 3D printed coral reef has been installed near the Maldives.
Oh, tell me about that in the Maldives, huh?
Yeah, 3D printers.
Where are the Maldives?
Maldives?
Yeah.
I really don't know. Does anyone know where the Maldives are?
Hey, Google. Good time for Google Maps here.
Yeah, Google knows.
Okay.
Okay, coral reefs, as most of you know, are very important. They're kind of like the Amazon jungle of the sea. You know, they're just rich with life forms that generate all kinds of activity. And we're beginning to see that they're as rich in biochemicals as the jungles. So the future of drug chemistry involves understanding all the creatures in the coral reefs and what they're doing. The fact that they're dying on this planet is of concern. But we have found that it's possible to recreate the reefs themselves with 3D printers.
Well, at least the
structure. The actual
structure, the calcified formation.
Yeah, and then that with this 3D printing technology, we could restore many of these reefs, which would be really cool. Several reefs have already been 3D printed and sunken into the ocean. And there's a company called Reef Design Labs, which is an Australian group that's dedicated to the creation of these reefs. And they just finished their largest one ever. It took them over 24 hours to print it. Then they used it to cast the structures in ceramic, which is similar to calcium carbonate found in the actual coral reefs. And the 3D printed molds, they were printed in Australia, then they were shipped to the Maldives. They were filled with concrete. They were assembled at a place called Summer Island and then dropped into the ocean where they now rest about 20 feet below the surface.
So the idea here is that we're going to seed new coral reefs in part of the ocean that isn't destroyed by too much heat from the warming of the oceans? We're going to just build reefs in cooler places?
Well, perhaps where they were and they died too. I think that's replacing the dead ones. Because what they do then is they take live coral, transplanted into the artificial reef, where it'll hopefully grow and colorize the artificial structure, forming a new leaf.
Okay, so we have one live coral. Because the thing about reefs is that the coral is the animal that nests in the calcified forms.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what's being destroyed by the challenges to the ocean. So if you just give them new calcified forms, you still need to seed that living part of the reef.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's what they're doing. They're transplanting living creatures into this new habitat. It's kind of like creating a whole bunch of apartment buildings and nobody has moved in yet.
Right.
You know, and you make it available for free and see if it populates.
Wow.
And maybe you bring in some creatures initially to help with the population, populating it.
Right.
The thing that comes to mind for me is that, well, there's a reason why these reefs died in the first place. And unless you change that, then the new residents might suffer the same fate.
Yeah, that was my concern. And it doesn't do anything to address the issues of why the reefs are dying, although it does localize it. It's sort of like fish farming. When the natural sources of fishing are depleted from unmanaged use, then people start creating managed ecosystems to replenish the supply.
Like farming coral reefs.
Yeah.
They say that it takes about two years for the reef to become fully populated. And we'll see. We'll see if it survives. Now, I understand sunscreen kills a lot of them. If they ban sunscreen in areas where this is a problem, then maybe they'll grow.
They did, actually. I think in Hawaii. They
oh, there you go. Okay. So as soon as we identify the problem, eliminate it, it'll work.
All right. We'll be right back. Here's a break.
Okay, welcome back to the show. We just got feedback from Mr. Panos on how a scientist has devised a solar reactor to make water and oxygen from moon rocks, tying in with our story on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. An aerospace engineer has built a machine that makes water and oxygen from the lunar regolith, powered by solar energy. Took him 10 years to build it.
All right. Once we put it on the moon, we'll be able to harvest some water right from the moon rocks, huh?
It creates enough oxygen and water to sustain 6 to 8 astronauts.
All right. Everybody's going to want one. Talk about a water closet.
Yeah. They're doing a 6-month test run on it now to see how well it works. Mm-hmm. If it holds up for that.
That's cool.
So there you go. So we're starting to develop the technology to make the moon more habitable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it has certain advantages. I mean, I don't know if you ever read Robert Heinlein, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Nope.
There's a number of ideas for the moon that could become quite valuable to us, including the fun. The amusement parks alone are worth the visit.
Uh-huh.
You know, 1/6 gravity. You can jump off of high cliffs and survive.
Ooh.
You can have great bouncy things.
Worlds.
Can you imagine bouncing 10 times higher than
great.
You can here?
Great. Sure.
And coming down slowly. And you're doing flips and stuff like that. Anybody who's into acrobatics is going to love it.
Yeah, the I Fly ride comes to mind.
Yeah, without having to listen to that noisy engine.
Right. We got to get there.
Yeah, making it more of a priority. But right now, we're working on the Earth itself. We're trying to keep it healthier. And the big thing about space is that it's a larger ecosystem. The lessons learned out there can be applied to the ecosystem here.
Well, and vice versa.
And vice versa, right.
Yeah.
And the more we become aware of how it's all interconnected and how it works, the more we'll be able to play in it.
Yeah, I think one of the big shifts in consciousness here on Earth is the idea of an ecosystem and the idea that you don't just strip mine resources from one place and then transport them to someplace else, like water. You actually need to be in cycle thinking so that the resources come back around from where they started to where they end up. And look what's going on with garbage. That is a classic example of how we're not approaching production, manufacturing, and waste as an ecosystem.
It's all part of a bigger ecosystem. It's all moving molecules around, in this case with garbage. And the molecules could be useful if you know how to separate them and combine them in the right ways. It's modern-day alchemy.
That's right.
To really be good at that. It's within our grasp.
Yeah. Well, we have to
we understand the principles.
Turn trash into
treasure. Yeah, we just have to get it out on a mass scale for it to really work. And look, in our lifetime, we're already doing a lot more recycling than we ever did as kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's evolving. Just maybe the next step will be even more. The last 30 years will happen in the next 5 years in terms of evolution of those ideas.
Yeah, we did create tools that accelerated our productivity, our ability to focus on a problem, generate solutions, and implement them. So we're moving faster than we used to, but probably just in time because the problems are bigger than they used to be.
Yeah, as usual, our species is right on the edge of mass extinction or
mass planetary enlightenment
or an awakening of some kind, hopefully, to what is, maybe to what actually is happening around us. Quite interesting. One of the things we've often heard about, and it's often a topic of late night radio, is the idea of the polar reversal, of the poles reversing, the north becoming the south, the south becoming the north.
Sure.
And there are all these tales about how there'll be 1,000-mile-an-hour winds if that happens.
Oh, yes. the last great extinction on the planet when people had to go into caves because the winds were so strong that they'd be whisked away unless they were underground.
Yes, so stay off the surface. No, I love the surface.
Yeah.
Can't say that.
I'm a sunbather. I want to be on the surface.
Yes. So a new scientific article came out on this topic called Earth's Magnetic Field Reversal Could Be More Rapid Than Thought.
Oh, okay. Well,
that sounds scary,
right? How fast is that?
Right. Well, they say right in the first statement in this article in International Business Times, an international team of researchers has found that Earth's magnetic field generated by material flowing in its core can reverse more rapidly than previously thought, posing a major threat to ground and space-based infrastructure. Major threat?
Hmm.
Read more to the next paragraph.
Okay, so let's see what's happening here. The poles are shifting. And how fast are they shifting
exactly? Well, you know, you have to read quite a ways through this article before they tell you.
Okay.
But when you get down to the bottom of the article,
they say the university studied the stalagmite and they found through the magnetic signature that
there was a big reversal. And a closer look at 16,000-year data reveals that it flipped within the last couple of centuries. In other words, it's 30 times faster than they thought before. 30 times
faster. Which means
faster.
That before they thought it was happening over thousands of years, and then they discovered that it happened over hundreds of years.
Right.
But it didn't happen
overnight. It didn't happen overnight.
Days.
Right. It's a century-long process at the very least for the North Pole to become the South become the North.
Okay.
That's the latest evidence to show it's that fast. But that's fast compared to what they were thinking before in terms of reversal every few thousands of years,
mm-hmm.
if not longer.
Right.
But still, it's not within our lifetime.
Yeah. But it may be, if it's over hundreds of years, then the evidence of the relocation of the North Pole and the magnetic north is giving us a clue that we're in some kind of process that may ultimately result in having a new north and a new south and a new warm climate zone and a new cold climate zone.
Are you worried?
Well, I choose not to worry. I would have to have more facts that it was going to affect me before I would have to worry about it. I just think it's theoretical at this point.
Well, I say the facts are that the Earth's magnetic field strength has declined by about 10% over the last century.
Mm-hmm.
And if these rapid flips are any indication, something similar could happen in the future, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe we've got a couple hundred years.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess if we live a lot longer, you seem to think is possible, then we may see it in our lifetime.
Yeah, we'll worry about it then.
That's what I say.
If it starts to change, it's going to take 1,000 years.
Then I'll worry about it.
The shift. It's going to take a long time to get to
where we're looking. You want to say hi to James and Bonnie Doon?
Yeah, let's say hi to James and Bonnie Doon.
Hi, James and Bonnie Doon. Welcome to the show.
Hey, James.
Hey, this is Future. So, yeah, I hope we don't have the pole reversal in our lifetime. I know it'll take several lifetimes, probably, at the new faster speed even.
I'm with you. I'm voting against it until later.
I'm voting against it, too. I'm not in favor.
All right.
The problem that we're not discussing is that the electromagnetic field shields us from, cosmic radiation and very dangerous radiation.
Yes, that's true.
And it might definitely play a role in evolution and mutation. And for that reason, I don't want to be around when it happens. It isn't just going to flip. It's going to go down to almost no magnetic field and then gradually come back up in reverse polarity.
Oh, what do you know about it, James? You sound like you're quite educated in that department.
Well, I'm not. I'm just logical. I mean, if it's going to take a long time, and we do know that it decreases quite a bit, and that's our main shield from radiation.
Yeah.
So, there's definitely things to be concerned about if it were to happen anytime soon or anytime when humanity's on the planet.
Probably more likely a solar flare would happen before the magnetic field would.
I would say probability wise, you're probably right. A big solar eruption would be a CME would probably be our next biggest worry. Yeah.
If you think about the magnetic field is being generated by the fact that we have an iron core that's rotating, right? It's a big battery. The planet's just got this big magnetic field going. So there'd have to be a real shift in the momentum of the iron in the core of the Earth.
Well, we know it's happened 189 times before, is what we know for a fact.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what, what actually makes the course change direction. That seems very bizarre to me, but I think geophysicists can see the evidence that they know of 189 times it's reversed.
Yeah. It's hard to study the core because it's so far down. No. Yeah.
I mean, that's theory, right? I mean, but obviously you have a magnetic field, so that's a good theory. But I haven't heard anyone suggest how a magnetic core stops spinning and reverses direction.
Yeah,
yeah,
I know.
Who really knows? We seem to know that Mars' core stopped turning for some reason.
Yeah.
I heard one theory that it is related to precession, and that might be controlling it. So that's one theory. That's the only one I've heard.
Yeah, I've heard volcanism, too, that part of our core is liquid.
Yeah. So anyway, I just thought I'd share that.
All right. Thanks, James.
Yeah.
We're going to go real quick. I'm with you. We'll have a voting block. Okay, let's say hi to Daddy Bird in Aptos. Hey, Daddy Bird.
Daddy Bird, how you doing?
You got about a minute here, friend.
I've been researching uranium mines the last couple months.
Uh-huh.
And I've learned that when they mine for uranium, it's quite common to find platinum. And there's calcites in the area, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
So, you think there's radioactivity on the asteroid?
Yeah, I think there is. I think there's, as I said, it's like a Home Depot for a solar system. There's everything. There's water even. There's a Ceres asteroid that contains a huge amount of water, more than the Earth. Just in solid form, though. It's frozen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Hey, guess what? We're right at the last 30 seconds here, so kind of got to say this is KSEO Santa Cruz, and Dr. Future will be back after the break, traffic, news, and weather with Sam Quentin. Okay, now you guys can take it away.
Okay, any final thoughts, Daddy Bird?
Where's the water come from?
It seems to be there. Now, where it's coming from, it's still a mystery.